ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hello, I'm Cassie Huff. Welcome to The Country Hour today on another rather wintry version of The Country Hour. It certainly has been quite a wet June for many areas of South Australia. I'd be interested to hear how things are travelling at your place, even just what your weekend totals might have been. You can text me on 0467 922 891 or phone 1300 222 891. It seems it's been wet and it's going to continue that way, particularly in the north of the state. So I'll catch up with the Weather Bureau in about 20 minutes or so to see just what is in store across the state, but the particular focus on the northern areas that are in for a bit of a downpour tomorrow, it seems. Also, Asian countries are stocking up on goat meat.
Now that the prices have softened because of some pressure on the household budget, we've seen these other markets like South Korea continue to grow, and then also places like China really increase their export volumes as well. And that has a lot to do with price.
More on the goat trade soon, but first, former Labor leader and Primary Industries Minister Simon Crean is being remembered as a man of great integrity who made Australia a better and fairer country. He died suddenly on the weekend, aged 74. He spent more than 20 years in federal politics and served as Cabinet Minister in the Hawke, Keating, Rudd and Gillard governments. One of his roles after politics was as chairman of the Australian Livestock Exporters Council. ALEC's current chief executive, Mark Harvey-Sutton, says it's a sad day for the industry.
I knew Simon to be a man of great integrity. He was a genuine carer of people. Lots of people understood the public persona of Simon, and he was a brilliant politician, but the Simon I knew was someone that always wanted to get the best out of people. He always took great care and interest in individuals, and, you know, he's left an indelible mark on me as a person and in my career. And when you think that I was only a small part of the incredible career he had, you know that that's going to be replicated right across the range of industries that he worked for. And I think that's the true testament of Simon, just the impact he had on people.
And can you tell our audience a bit about how he got that job as chair of ALEC? Because at the time, for some people, it perhaps may have seemed an odd choice to hire a former Labor politician who was in government during that time of the live export ban. How did it all come to be?
Well, it predates me. And the only reason I say that is I don't know the intimate workings, but yep. I do know that he felt a great obligation towards the industry. He knew that the industry had been wronged in 2011. And he knew the great damage that it had done to that industry. And he wanted to make sure or repay that, I guess. And I think that speaks to the man. But the other thing, of course, he knew that 2011, there were animal welfare challenges. There were issues that had to be addressed. And he took with great vigour the responsibility to make sure that the industry acknowledge that responsibility towards animal welfare and was on a trajectory of continuous improvement of animal welfare. And I think that was the thing he was proudest of, that he took industry to the point where it had to acknowledge that responsibility and work on it. But he also wanted to make sure that the wrongs were corrected and see the industry grow, which is incredibly important.
Do you ever wish he'd been more public in some of his views around live export trade?
I think Simon always never took a backward step. I think he was a great spokesperson for the industry. The thing that always we need to remember as a sector is Simon had the politics of his career been different. He could have quite easily have been Prime Minister. He had the intellect and the capability to do it. And that was the caliber of the man that chose our industry to be a leader for. And I think that speaks great volumes about our industry, but also speaks great volumes about Simon. I think he just was an incredible leader. He always took a lot of pride in the fact that he was the representative for our industry. So, look, I can't think of a circumstance where he wasn't public about that. So I would say he always wore the industry as a badge of honour, and he was incredibly proud that he could contribute to it.
That was Mark Harvey Sutton, CEO of the Australian Livestock Exporters Council, speaking with Matt Bran. To the Eyre Peninsula now, and more than 140 hectares of native vegetation will be protected for years to come on the Eastern Eyre Peninsula under a biodiversity credit exchange program. Now, the Department for Environment, Water and Eyre Peninsula Landscape Board is helping deliver the program for the Native Vegetation Council. The program, which has also been delivered across other parts of the state, gives landholders access to funding to protect, manage and restore areas of native vegetation. Their credits are then sold to buyers who are required to offset vegetation clearances in the same region. Planning and Assessment Officer with the EP Landscape Board, Andrew Freeman, explains.
Last year, there was an opportunity for landholders in two areas of Eyre Peninsula to effectively apply for funds to manage vegetation on their properties. The funding came from the Native Vegetation Council for offsets for clearances done by others, mainly in the past.
And so who took on this opportunity?
Yes, yeah, so we've had a couple of landholders, one up near Cowell and one up near Cleve, that have taken the opportunity. We had more applicants than that apply. People had to put areas of vegetation under heritage agreement, so some applicants decided then that wasn't something they wanted to do, which is fine, and they also had to put in applications that the Native Veg Council found viable to fund, whether, you know, they had to have enough environmental benefit and also be cost effective.
So they received this funding. What did they essentially have to do as part of it?
Yes, yeah, so I guess they had to initially put a submission into us. So board staff went out and assessed the sites, looked at the vegetation condition and other attributes of the area. And then they had to put a bid in for how much they wanted money-wise to achieve environmental outcomes over the next 10 years. So that might have been environmental weed control, might have been erecting fencing to keep stock out of areas, it might have been doing pest control like rabbits and foxes. So they had to show over the next 10 years an environmental gain and the ways they were going to achieve that.
And then also be able to generate biodiversity credits, is that right?
Yeah, so as a result of that gain that they get over the next 10 years through a number of equations, the Native Veg Council will work out how much credit that is, and then that's how they work out how much the landholder gets paid for delivering those services, I guess you'd call them.
What would they then do with those credits?
So the Native Veg Council will effectively, you know, they have effectively bought those credits off the landholders by the incentive payments to do the activities, and then the Native Veg Council can use those credits to sell to some of the other companies that have to do clearance to offset the clearance that companies need to do to undertake development.
Why has this project worked well on the Eyre Peninsula?
It's been trialled in a couple of other areas of the state. It gave opportunity for landholders to look into this space. It gives landholders another income stream just from, you know, by managing vegetation on their property, they get payments. It's not something that's been commonplace anywhere anymore, but I guess the world is changing, and I think, you know, with the carbon credits and biodiversity credits like this, I think there'll be more opportunities for people who own land to manage biodiversity for everybody and get paid for it.
Planning and Assessment Officer with the Eyre Peninsula Landscape Board, Andrew Freeman. Tony Hull has land near Cowell and was one of the successful applicants for the program. He says he wanted to be able to lock down and look after some key native veg on his property.
The opportunity arose to improve some of the areas of native vegetation that I've got on the property. There's probably about 40% of the farm is actually a native vegetation, some of it in fairly average condition due to livestock and also probably kangaroos and emus. So for me, the opportunity to have a lot of the fencing and noxious weed removal covered gave me an opportunity to tidy up some of my native veg and over the next 10 years, get it back into a condition that is hopefully a lot better than what it's presently in.
And you've fenced off this area as well to stop stock getting in?
Yeah, so I've actually got hold of recycled plastic-coated timber posts. So they're a product that comes out of Queensland, but they are fully recycled, the plastics, and actually the pricing on those was pretty good. So we looked at that as an option. Also as an example of using recycled goods, and also the longevity of those types of posts are generally superior to the timber posts. So, yeah, we fenced the whole area off, hopefully in an effort to not only stock-proof it, but try and keep vermin out as well.
And I believe using local businesses as well, which means that the funding flows back into the local community.
Yeah, so a lot of the materials bar the posts have been purchased locally. We've used local fencing contractor, and I've also used local labour to... a lot of the country was infested with box thorns, so the issue we've had with the box thorns was we've used mechanical methods using a telehandler and also spraying, so I've used local contractors for that as well.
What can you see this area being used for down the track once it has been restored?
Well, probably nothing from a productivity point of view, but more improving different animal species and the flora and fauna within the project area itself. So to me, it's more about just improving the overall native vegetation on the property and try and getting some of those rare species and back into the system again.
And Tony, did you know much about biodiversity credits and what you could do there with selling them back to the Native Veg Council?
Yeah, it's an interesting market, the biodiversity credits. It's a market that's probably not well known, but generally the opportunity exists to sell your biodiversity credits based on an assessment that the Native Veg Council undertake or different consultants undertake, and it's worked via a scoring or a point scoring system, and then different businesses or corporations that clear land can then buy those biodiversity credits to offset their clearing. And generally probably the worst the native vegetation condition is, the more value it is to the purchasers, given that over time the improvement on the native vegetation is more significant than say an area that's pristine, for example.
How significant is yours at the moment?
There's obviously a lot of species within the area that are still there, but not in an abundance like they would once have been. So there's a lot of evidence of obviously livestock damage and kangaroo and emu damage, but more so probably the box thorns that have taken over and infested a lot of the areas. That's where we'll see significant improvement with the vegetation, with the removal of those. And of course, that's going to be an ongoing management, something we'll have to attend to every year, looking at removing any of the smaller tuckers, etc., that come up. So we're expecting some significant improvement in that area over the next 5 to 10 years.
Tony Hull, who has land near Cowal and is part of the Biodiversity Credit Exchange Program, speaking with Brooke Neindorf. Weather's up next after this story. It is 18 minutes past 12.
You're listening to Cassie Huff on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Well, China is stocking up on cheap Australian goat meat. According to Meat and Livestock Australia, goat meat exports to China surged 2,300 tonnes in the first quarter of the year, positioning it as Australia's second largest export market after the United States for that period. As MLA's senior market information analyst Ripley Atkinson explains, the main driver was price, with Australian goat meat now $6 cheaper than it was this time last year. He's speaking here with Cara Jeffrey about the burgeoning market.
Overall, we've seen goat meat exports year-to-date 27% higher compared to last year, and that's across all markets. But really positively, the improvements we've seen in markets that are really growing their sort of demand and taste for Australian product is definitely China, South Korea. So places like those, Taiwan's another example, they've really export volumes to these countries have improved really strongly this year. Price has a lot to do with that, but those three as examples have been sort of the highlight so far for goat meat exports.
The price in Australia for over the hooks price for goat meat sitting around 320 cents a kilo at the moment. This time in June last year, it was around 920 cents a kilogram. So why has the price come back so much?
A lot of the adjustment we've seen certainly in price of domestic goats over the hooks has to do with supply. So quarter one supply of goat slaughter in the first quarter of this year was about 40% above the five-year average. So we were killing, in the first quarter of the year, we killed about 430,000 head of goats. The long-term average is 188,000 head. So because supply is so much more significant, that is placing downward pressure on the market. And internationally, goat prices were also very, very high. When you compare them, say, in the United States market to mutton, they're about $5 a kilo dearer. The challenge with that is for the consumer or the importer, purchasing a product that's that expensive sometimes incentivizes buyers, importers or consumers to look elsewhere. Now that the prices have softened, because of some pressure on the household budget, we've seen these other markets like South Korea continue to grow, and then also places like China really increase their export volumes as well. And that has a lot to do with price.
And North America's been the largest market for Australian goat meat for over two decades. So I guess why does it remain such a strong market?
Yeah, you rightly point out. Sort of on average, between 55 and 60% of our total goat meat exports goes to the United States each year. The reason being really is that has a lot to do with the cultural diversity and the cultural groups or communities of people in the United States that identify with consuming goat meat. The Hispanics are an example of that, and they recognise that that's a really major part of their diet and the way they eat. And obviously, we've got the capacity to provide them that product, and that's why they've been such a stable mainstay and key market for us over such a long time.
Domestically in Australia, with that over the hooks price sitting just above 300 cents a kilo, how are producers handling that? Do they have the supply to make up the shortfall in price? Is it evening out that way compared to getting that high of 920 cents this time last year?
So yes, the market's declined by about $6 a kilo compared to 12 months ago for the goat meat OTH indicator. These prices have also declined, across sheep and lambs and cattle too. So goats aren't just isolated. They're not the only sort of species that has been impacted by price. But you've also got to remember now producers are selling more animals as well. So, with more animals, obviously can offset some of that decline in price also from higher numbers being sent to be processed. And that's obviously a positive. We know goats are becoming a really major part of a lot of people's enterprises across Western Queensland and New South Wales, and the introduction of exclusion fencing is really important and key to sort of maintaining that market share that goats now have as an enterprise option throughout the country.
With the forecast of a drier spring, is there an expectation that supply could back off and therefore that price could come up in Australia?
No one's in a drought yet. When you look at the Bureau of Meteorology's data, there's no major part of Australia's regions or, Australian livestock producing regions that are in drought. And at the minute, we're still not declared that a drought will occur. So the key factor for driving the improvement or change in price will be supply, and if supply tightens in time, that will obviously play a major role in how price performs. The other factor is global dynamics and demand on the import side or the export space. If the interest and demand is there to continue to provide more product due to a protein deficit, say, in certain markets or generally across the globe, that will lift demand for our goat meat product, which will then support higher prices here domestically.
Just a bit bigger picture, where does goat meat production in Australia sit globally?
In terms of global production, we're very small. But in terms of global exports, we're the biggest goat meat exporter in the world. So because our domestic consumption is quite low and we have a really sophisticated relationship and engagement through free trade agreements across the world, in sort of all continents, essentially, we are the biggest goat meat exporter. So our production terms are very small relative to other countries, but our export volumes are recognised as the biggest exporter.
Meat and Livestock Australia's Senior Market Information Analyst Ripley Atkinson speaking with Cara Jeffrey. To Senior Forecaster Jenny Horvat from the Bureau of Meteorology. And now, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Cassie.
So it was a bit of a wet weekend and there's more rain on the way, especially in the north. What are you seeing?
Yeah, that's right. So we do have an upper level system that's going to bring some rain in from the northwest. So we are seeing that cloud band developing at the moment. So we are seeing a lot of clouds streaming in across the north, northwest of the state. And that system extends all the way into WA and bordering with Northern Territory as well. Up embedded with that, and we are also seeing a little bit of thunderstorm activity with near the NT border, and as a result of that system we do actually have a flood watch current for parts of the northeast pastoral district, and this morning they've included the Flinders district for that. So that's this with this upper system bringing areas of rainfall for the north of the state. So like I said, starting today but really starting to pick up on Tuesday and then moving more to the northeastern parts on the Wednesday there. So it's a little bit unseasonal to be seeing this rainfall coming across from the northwest. They're normally those summer type patterns, so we are likely to see that intensifying as it moves northeastward. So yeah, we are looking at some of that heavy rainfall within that area. So we can expect to see some ponding and likely to see some rises in the local creeks through there. So expecting those outback roads to be impacted. So if you are travelling up north, definitely have a look at the website from the Department of Transport to keep an eye out on what impacts that are occurring up there. And it has been a bit of a wet week for South Australia last week with the system that moved through with the highest totals observed. So I've got some 7-day rainfall totals up until 9 a.m. this morning. So up around Woodhurst we saw 130 millimetres and a few other locations around the Mount Lofty Ranges picking up a good 100 millimetres. Broadly across there we saw falls of 50 to 80 millimetres. Other notable places we did see parts of the northwest pastoral district, Mount Ive, picking up around 35 millimetres for the week. Up in the Flinders, Melrose picking up around 45 for the week. Mid-north Snowtown also picking up around 44 millimetres through there. Out on the west coast, Streaky Bay picking up just under 50 millimetres of rain, and down at Coulter in the lower Eyre Peninsula over 70 millimetres of rain. Around the Murraylands, Malang picking up around 35 millimetres. Kangaroo Island also saw some totals there of near or 100 millimetres around Pandana and Cape Border. York Peninsula was varied, but we saw nearly 88 millimetres at Stenhouse Bay for the week. And down in the southeast, we saw Kingston picking up around 57 millimetres and Canalpam around 48. So some widespread rainfall last week and some more coming across the north of the state. So we are expecting that to thicken up today. Further south, we've got a bit of a moist westerly airstream. So we are still seeing some shower activity, mainly around the southern agricultural area, but we're not expecting those totals to be overly significant compared to what we saw last week. So still seeing that shower activity in the south for today and tomorrow. Bit of a front clipping the south on Wednesday. So pretty much most of the state will see some rainfall in the south with that front pushing up from the southwest and across northern and northeastern parts with that rain band moving through there. So it'll be interesting to see where that boundary is between the two systems. So whether it's sort of got that rainfall pushing down to the Riverland and the mid-north, but then they could also see some showers pushing up from Wednesday from that front. So we'll see how that evolves through there. So a bit of a wet day for the state again on Wednesday. Maybe not likely to see as higher totals as we did in one day last week, but nevertheless some pretty significant falls coming through on the Wednesday through there. On Thursday we'll see that rain really starting to clear off to the northeast, but we're still maintaining those showers in the south with a broad sort of westerly flow. Another feature clipping on the Friday, enhancing those showers around the southeast. So we can expect to see totals of up to 30 to 60 millimetres about northern and central pass with this rain coming through. Cassie.
Thanks for that, Jenny. A bit to look out for on your synoptic charts.
No worries.
Jenny Horvat from the Bureau of Meteorology. In the far west of New South Wales, the Upper Western's cloudy tomorrow. There's a high chance of rain in the west, medium chance elsewhere, but looks like they're picking up on some of that system because there are heavy falls possible as well. Overnight temperatures will fall to between 3 and 9 degrees, but the daytime temperatures will reach 12 to 19. The Lower Western will be partly cloudy and there is a medium chance of showers, most likely in the late morning. Overnight down to 1 to 7 degrees, daytime temperatures reaching 14 to 17 degrees. I've got more to come on the Country Hour as we approach 12:30.
You're listening to the Country Hour. For more stories from across the country, go to abc.net.au/rural. On ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill, this is Cassie Huff. Cassie Huff.
Hello, it's great to have your company today. I am Cassie Huff and it's been rather wet weekend and there's a bit more rain on the way. We'll take a look at what that's going to mean for those dams in the Adelaide Hills that are looking a little precarious. And on another topic, are you ready to eat meat that's grown in a lab from the cells of an animal? So we're not talking about a plant-based protein. This is actually meat that's grown from the cells. Perhaps you have reservations about taste or maybe safety?
It is a very onerous process. They require an enormous amount of data. They ask questions about everything. There is an enormously complex food safety plan that we put together that they go through in really, really rigorous detail to just answer the question, is this safe for something to introduce to our diet?
I'll have more on the future of cultured meat in this country. Also, the future of shearing in this country looks to be in good hands. I'll have some of the results from the Golden Shears World Championships that have been held in Edinburgh across the weekend. But we'll find out first what's happening in news with the latest from Matt Coleman. Good afternoon.
Hello, Cassie. In the news this afternoon, this year's Adelaide Fringe is estimated to have supported nearly 10,000 direct and indirect jobs. Organisers say it was a record year for the event, which sold 1 million tickets for the first time. It's also been estimated 45,000 visitors came to the state during the festival. The Commonwealth Bank says it's urgently working to fix widespread technical problems which have denied customers access to their accounts today. Customers of Australia's largest bank have had their cards declined in shops. They've also been able to use online banking or the mobile app. As it works to fix the problem, the Commonwealth Bank is referring customers to its website for updates. And the Mount Gambier Council says a hole that appeared in the city centre yesterday appears to be a natural sinkhole rather than because of infrastructure failing underground. A 2 metre wide and deep sinkhole appeared on a path between Margaret Street and the Raillands Park on Sunday morning after heavy rain over the weekend. The councillors blocked off the area to the public because of safety concerns. More news at 1 o'clock.
Thanks for that. That was Matt Coleman there with the latest in the news headlines. To the hills now, and the South Australian State Emergency Service is monitoring two dams in the Adelaide Hills. There is still a risk of dam failure in Basket Range, at the dam in Basket Range, and one at Hope Forest. State Duty Officer for the South Australian SES, Molly Gifford, has an update on the situation.
So we have one dam in Hope Forest. Our listeners would have seen the warnings out for areas in Hope Forest and Basket Range. They're both emerging situations. For Hope Forest, we do have engineers down on site exploring options for potential opening of the spillway and for some rectification works. So an emerging situation with Hope Forest Dam and similar situation with Basket Range Dam. We are just continuing to monitor the situation. There's not a dam failure issue at the moment, but again, we're just continuing to monitor that situation as well.
And beyond the spillways, I understand you're also pumping water out of those dams as well?
Yes, for Basket Range, we have been doing a bit of siphoning of water out, so a bit of pumping just downstream, so continuing to monitor that. We're not sure how long. We'll probably continue doing that into the week until those levels in the dam have reached a safe level that our engineers are happy with. So I think no word on how long we'll be pumping for, but that will continue until needed.
With the Basket Range and Hope Forest dams, what advice is there at the moment for people who live in that area who may be affected if there is an issue with those dams?
We would just tell those living within the areas, obviously there are some local road closures, so just respect those local road closures and just keep updated with our messaging. We still have warnings current for those two areas downstream, so just keep abreast of the information that we are releasing, and if they have any questions or any concerns, our number is 132500.
Which roads are actually closed?
It's an emerging situation. I think it's Lobethal Road from in Basket Range, from Ashton to Basket Range, is closed until further notice. And I'll just wait and confirm on the Hope Forest Dam, but that should be included in the local communications for these warnings.
And how concerned is the SES about the upcoming wet weather that is forecast for this week as well?
I think a lot of the weather that we are expected is largely in the northwest. We understand that all of our catchments across the state are quite saturated, but we would just encourage the community to keep aware of all of the warnings that are in place, maintain situational looking on social media and following the directions of the State Emergency Service.
Given there was the Echunga Dam situation last year, I'm sure people are a bit more aware of the need for dam safety and just checking them. What is your advice for people, given it is rather wet at the moment, around their dams and keeping them safe?
Absolutely. We'd encourage all dam owners to just keep an eye on their dams and ensure, look upstream, look downstream. And if there's any life-threatening situations, always 000. But if you're not quite sure or if there is an incident where you think there may be some flood activity, our number is 132500. And there's also further information on our website. So if people visit ses.sa.gov.au on the flood tab, and they'll be able to find out a bit more information on what to do if you do notice anything, any issues with your dam.
And speaking of this heavy rain, there is expected to be quite heavy rain come across the north of the state. What are you expecting there?
Absolutely. So we are looking, Tuesday is looking to be the worst of that weather, so affecting Coober Pedy, Ernambella, Ceduna, Nullarbor, Tarcoola, Tuggmore and Unundata areas. Members of the public are advised to check transport routes, don't drive through floodwaters, avoid isolation due to road closures, so just keeping in mind that your normal access routes might not be available, and again, just keep updated on social media and on our website on ses.sa.gov.au.
State Duty Officer with the South Australian SES, Molly Gifford, speaking there. And do keep an eye out for road closures in the north of the state, given those predicted rainfalls, if you are actually travelling around in that area. Now, to a topic that can divide people, it's certainly a bit intriguing, and I'm wondering if you are ready to eat meat that's grown in a lab from the cells of an animal, because cultured meat could well be on sale in Australia as early as next year. So take a listen to this. Let me know what you think. You can text in on 0467 922 891 or phone 1300 222 891. Fiona Broom has a bit of an update on where cultured meat is up to.
It's the stuff of science fiction. Slaughter-free meat spawned from animal cells in a lab and grown in a factory. According to Australia's food regulator, cell-based meat is produced from animal cells using biotechnology, tissue engineering, molecular biology, and synthetic processes. The US has just approved two cell-based chicken products for sale to consumers, after Singapore approved a cell-based chicken nugget a couple of years ago. So could Australia be next? Here's the founder of Melbourne-based cultivated meat company Magic Valley, Paul Bevan.
The US is such a massive market, and a lot of the regulators take their lead from what the FDA and the USDA does or approves. This will see products finally come to market, you know, for the consumer.
So what does the regulator think? Here's Glenn Neal, the Risk Management and Intelligence General Manager at Food Standards Australia New Zealand.
Rights to such foods would be deemed to be a novel food. There's no traditional history of safe consumption, and so therefore they trigger what's known as our novel food pre-market safety assessment. So that requires a formal application to VSANS, Food Standards Australia New Zealand, where our experts will pore over the detail of that, make sure that any such application would generate a safe product in terms of the protection of public health and safety, and we would go about consulting on any such application throughout a process as well. So we've actually received one of those applications. We received one in February, and we're working our way through that that first application. We expect to consult on that in late August of this year.
Do you have a rough timeline of how long it takes for a company to be approved?
A novel food assessment typically takes between 9 and 12 months, and our current plan for that first application is that it will be completed by March 2024.
And so once a company gains approval, if they gain approval, how long until that cultured meat could be hitting the shelves?
As far as VSANS is concerned, it could be on the shelves the following days.
Cultured meat company Vow has made the first product approval application. Here's George Pepu, the founder and CEO.
I don't expect the USDA decision is going to have any impact on the Australian market. We've been working with Food Standards Australia and New Zealand ourselves for quite some time. We have the first application that they're assessing for cultured meat in Australia.
What's that process been like? Is it quite an onerous process?
It is a very onerous process. They require an enormous amount of data. They ask questions about everything. There is an enormously complex food safety plan that we put together that they go through in really, really rigorous detail to just answer the question, is this safe for something to introduce to our diet?
How does it feel to be, I guess, the guinea pig in this process, being the first people to put in an application?
Honestly, it's been a really positive experience. We have been developing our process and consulting a lot with regulators like the Australian regulator, but also overseas regulators in Singapore and the US, to ensure that everything that we're doing is using the latest knowledge around food safety and how to operate these processes safely.
And Magic Valley's Paul Bevan says they're not far off making their own application to VSANS.
We've been talking to the regulators for about 18 months now about preparing our application, our formal application. We plan on doing that in the second half of this year, which would see us hopefully being able to commercialise products by the end of 2024.
Can you talk me through some of your products?
We've developed two products so far, which are both a mince meat product. We've developed a lamb mince product and a pork mince product. We've recently held a number of taste testings, and the feedback has been really great in terms of taste, the flavour, the aroma, etc. But it will be those mince meat type products, which we would consider to be an unstructured product, which will be the first products that we look to bring to market, with the focus on, you know, the structured products. And by structured, I mean things like, you know, steak and chops and those sorts of things, a couple of years down the track.
But George Pepu says Vow is focused on a different market altogether.
We've always taken the approach of trying to create as much choice and as many options as possible. And the really fun and exciting part about this is we can create foods and cuts and experiences and nutritional profiles which don't directly replicate what animals can produce. They can offer things that are entirely new to our diet.
So rather than it being a replacement, it's a different option entirely.
Exactly. And that's always been for me as a meat eater. What has been really exciting about this proposition of cultured meat, it's not about making what we have today. We're not trying to compete with the, you know, pub steak. It's an ability to introduce entirely new types of proteins that offer sensory experiences, nutritional profiles or functions in our diet that we can't currently satisfy.
Cell-grown meat might look, taste and feel the same as farmed meat, but does it offer the same nutrition? Back to George Pepu.
Overall, all of our nutrient testing of our first product, which is cultured quail, has revealed that it's very, very similar in composition to traditionally farmed quail. And that includes all of the micro and macronutrients. They're all in similar ranges. Food Standards ANZ, as part of our approval process, reveal or share our entire safety information, which does include our nutritional information transparently.
And here's Paul Bevan again.
We are doing a little bit more work on the nutritional profile of those products throughout the next few months before we apply for regulatory approval.
Can you call a lab-grown meat product steak? Is it meat?
Well, it's definitely meat. It's molecularly identical to traditionally farmed meat. So, you know, the cells that we obtain to start the process with are from an animal. So the products are definitely meat. Labelling is probably a different conversation around what the product will be labelled.
Glenn Neal from Fazans says the regulatory body considers nutrition as part of its safety review. He says how cultured meat products are labelled will be another issue to consider.
So the code requires that use of terms such as meat and milk are qualified where they're used so as to avoid confusion of consumers. So the code requires, the Food Standards Code requires that consumers are informed and that any misleading or deceptive conduct is prevented. Very mindful of the need for consumers to understand that these products potentially are the same as meat in terms of needing refrigeration and cooking. That's really important for consumers to understand that, but it's also at the same time, it's very important they understand that that these products have come through a different process and make an informed choice around that.
So is the primary consideration there in labelling and packaging the impact on consumers, or does it take industries into consideration as well?
Oh, it's absolutely focused on the consumer.
So what might cultivated meat cost when it does hit the shelves? Will it give the farmed livestock industry a run for its money? Here's Paul Bevan.
At the moment, with our initial product, we'd be looking at around a $5 to $6 per burger cost. So once we get into, you know, a larger manufacturing facility, we believe the cost will come down to less than a dollar a burger.
How does that compare to farmed meat? Is that about on par or is that cheaper?
At the moment, I think we're slightly more expensive, but at scale and once we get to, you know, below a dollar a burger, I think it would be substantially cheaper than current prices for traditionally farmed meat. Cultivated meat provides a really exceptional option in terms of a sustainable solution for people that want to continue to eat animal proteins. And I think that will happen a lot sooner than people think. You know, I'd expect to be seeing plenty of products on shelves, you know, within the next 2 to 3 years. Certainly having, you know, such a huge country as or a huge market as the US provide approval for those products certainly opens up a lot of doors industry-wide for those products to be available to consumers.
Back to George Pepu.
When we're introducing cultured meat, we know it's going to be a premium market. And so you'll really only find this in the types of high-end restaurants and venues that you're paying quite a lot to eat at in maybe one or two dishes. It's going to be around the same price point as some of those premium meats that you'd start with. And for that reason, we're very focused on export markets and serving outside of Australia.
So Val cultured meats won't be replacing the Aussie barbecue in the future?
Definitely not. We're not expecting to replace the pub steak.
Val founder and CEO George Pepu ending that report from Fiona Broom. And we've got a couple of texts that have come in regarding this. Luke from Hallett Cove says, I'm sorry, if it doesn't eat, drink, moo, bleat and cluck, I'm not eating it. And Marjorie also has similar strong feelings, saying, please don't call it meat. It's an insult to the farmers. It's certainly a new way of thinking about it, that something like that could be grown in a petri dish, I guess. But it's happening. It's not commercial yet, but as you heard there, there's a lot of work going into it. So we will keep following the development of that as a food source. It is coming up to 13 minutes to one.
Are you looking for trusty plants that will grow in a shady spot? Wondering which shrubs are best for hedging? Or maybe you need some help with your winter pruning? Find the answers in the July issue of ABC Gardening Australia magazine. Check out the amazing array of winter flowering plants and get tips on growing top-class rhubarb and perfect parsnips. Gardening Australia magazine, available from newsagents and abcmagazines.com.au.
On digital and on mobile.
ABC South Australia and Broken Hill.
But another text here just on this concept around cultured meat, saying that someone's wondering what it tastes like and is it just beef or can you do it with any animal? Well, it does seem like they can do it with any animal. I think that company Vow is actually looking at doing it with all sorts of exotic animals to look at potentially growing meat from them as well. Also, Val from Port Lincoln has said, no cultured meats for me. Hope labelling is very clear. I'm sure it would have to be very clear. Now, around about this time last year, farm firefighting units were support for them were being supported by the government. Now, the second round of grants for farm firefighting units are being launched today. The government has put $2 million over 4 years to allow landholders to purchase equipment to improve community safety and capability to respond to fire emergencies. And last year, the program was actually massively oversubscribed. There were about 1,247 applications in less than a month. So there were many people who actually might have missed out because I think there was only about $500,000 available in the whole system, in the whole lot. So there were people who missed out, but there is the possibility that they might be able to be launched. You might be able to get your hands on them this time around. And it's being launched again by Minister for Emergency Services, Joe Sockarch. Good afternoon.
Hi, Cassie. Very good to be with you.
Great to have your company. So, as I was saying, you had about 1,200 applications in less than a month last year, and I think you were actually kind of blown away by how popular this program was. You're launching it again this year. How much money is on the table for this year's round?
Yeah, that's right. So this is year two of our four-year minimum commitment. So it's another $500,000 this year that's now open. And look, I'm not sure the reflection would be that I was blown away. Look, I'm always blown away by the absolute commitment that regional communities have towards fire safety, but also as being part of that first response to fires. But I've got to admit that we knew this would be a popular one. That's exactly why we committed before the last election to reinstate this program. We knew it was a popular program, and we know it's a popular program because people are absolutely committed to doing the right thing. So anyone who applied last year that was not able to be successful is absolutely able to apply again. I've been really eager for that to occur. So if anyone missed out last year, please jump online to the CFS website and apply again. And those people that missed out last year or haven't achieved or been awarded some of the grant funding will be prioritised. So if you've had no success so far, you will be prioritised this year and into the future. And we've actually made a few expansions this year as well, just a few tweaks around me getting out and about to regional communities and meeting with a few of the both successful and unsuccessful applications last year around further expanding the program. So the first expansion will be for landowners, and that is particularly around focusing on those conservation owners or conservationists who weren't able to be applying last year because they weren't undertaking farming operations. So we're going to expand it this year to landowners and particularly with an eye on conservation groups. And the second expansion will be for community groups. One in particular, the Butte Lions Club, who I met with not too long ago, were successful in applying for grants, but they were only successful because each individual of that group were able to apply and were successful in personal protective clothing. So what we've done is to open up the expansion this year for those community groups so that they can apply in the same way that the Butte Lions Club did for personal protective clothing to keep them safe on the fire ground.
There was some concern, yeah, that people who... Is this only open for people who do have a sort of primary production connection? Because I know there were some people in the Adelaide Hills who were concerned they weren't going to be able to access it because they weren't a primary producer.
Yeah, that's right. So this year it's been expanded so that those people that you refer to, so for example, those individuals in the Adelaide Hills that might not be undertaking primary production will be able to apply because we know that they're very much focused on fire safety being part of the first response on both their property as well as neighbouring properties. So really, really pleased to see this year that we've been able to expand it to not only cover primary producers but also non-primary producing landowners as well.
What were the most popular things that people applied for?
The most popular by number were items of protective personal clothing. So things like gloves, things like jackets, pants, eye protection, and largely they were for individuals who may have already had a farm firefighting unit, but were able through this grant process to equip themselves in a much safer way, so that they could respond as part on their FFU or with their FFU in a much much safer way that protects their own safety when fire is coming through. There was also a very significant number, I think about 130 in the end, radios. And again, we know that when it comes to the front line of a fire, communication is just so critical. And communication is not just critical to ensure that the best plan of attack is able to be implemented, but it's about personal safety. So right through all of these grants, it's been a real strong focus on the safety of our farmers, the safety of our primary producers and regional communities. And we know that they're already doing a great job with their FFUs, and we want to make sure that they're as safe as they possibly can be whilst they're doing that.
When will the application process close?
So they're going to close well and truly this side of the fire danger season again. So they're going to close on Friday, the 4th of August. And the reason, again, that we're running this program across the coldest, wettest time of the year when it comes to fires is really about getting the applications assessed independently, awarded, and getting the new gear, the new personal protective equipment, the new radios, the new FFUs into people's hands by the time they need them a bit later this year when things get hotter and drier.
Well, it was a very popular program, and I've got a couple of texts from Adelaide Hills people very keen to get their hands on it as well. I think they weren't able to last year, as you mentioned, so some strong support there. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks, Cassie.
That was Joe Sockarch, Minister for Emergency Services, speaking there about the second round of grants for farm firefighting units. Mary from Norwood thinks there should be a bit more money in the kitty for this after the money that was spent on other sporting events. Finally today, the future of shearing is in good hands, according to Tom Kelly, the manager of the team which represented Australia at the Golden Shears World Championships in Edinburgh across the weekend. The Australian team registered some standout results, including fifth place to John Daller in the blade shearing, a good South Australian there, and fourth to Daller and Andrew Murray in the teams event. Angus Furley spoke to Tom Kelly, who said the atmosphere had been electric.
Yeah, magnificent. Look, they've had a great few days here. Really high level of competition. So world shearing and wool handling just seems to keep going to new levels. And look, the Aussie crew really worked hard. We've had some good results. John Daller's made a blades final and finished fifth. We've had John Daller and Andrew Murray finish fourth in the world blades teams. Rachel Hutchins, the New South Wales wool handler, has finished eighth individually, and her and Mark Purcell come sixth in the World Wool Handling Teams event. Our machine shearers worked really hard. I think Nathan Meaney was 14th, and Daniel McIntyre was about 16th, I reckon.
Tom, just explain how high the standard of competition's been, and also how tough it's been for the Australians shearing unfamiliar sheep in unfamiliar conditions and handling unfamiliar wool for the wool handlers.
Yeah, look, it's a whole different, whole new world. Electrifying pace, like, you know, Gavin Much, sure in the first heat, is a past world champion, a Scotsman, and he's sure... four big Scottish mules they were shearing. He shore them in 3 minutes flat, and it sort of just electrified the whole event. The machine shearing's been dominated by the Welshmen.
And tell me about that, Tom, because I think they recorded first and second.
Yeah. So young fella Gowan Evans has won the World Machine Shearing Championship. From the old world champion now, fella Jones there. So they had a real battle in the final there, over 20 sheep. Shorn 20 Cheviot ewes in 15 minutes. And yeah, like at a real high standard of quality. So it's tough, you know. Even our neighbours, the New Zealanders, it's even they were sort of battling to sort of hold their ground in the competition, so it gets pretty tough at the top.
Tom, I'd be interested to know, obviously in Australia the shearing industry has had some tough times with staffing shortages particularly. Have you had a sense of what that's like in other countries?
Yeah, they're probably all sort of looking to develop sort of pathways of teaching and bringing, you know, attracting sort of young people and trying to keep the standards up and that. So many different stories of where that's at all around the world.
And how important, talking about attracting people to the industry, how important are competitions like these in marketing the industry?
Look, it was unbelievable there today. Like, the, I don't know how many people, we got a seat. You get your seat in there and you're too frightened to move because if you go outside, you can't get back in. Like, the McRoberts Stadium down here was absolutely packed there. Yeah, so it attracts a lot of young people at the competition, and yeah, like, it's exciting. It's it's been huge here for the few days, and the quality of it, like, the quality really shone through. Like, the competitors that are able to achieve that real elite quality are the ones that have ended up winning. So the system works well in that regard, you know, the judging system and everything.
Tom Kelly, manager of the team that represented Australia at the Golden Shears event in Edinburgh across the weekend, speaking with Angus Verley. Big congratulations there. A couple of last texts. Travis, in regard to the cultured meat, how gross we might mutate into our animals into ourselves. And another text saying, I'm all for cultured meat for humane and environmental reasons. That's all we have time for in the program today. It's coming up to 1 o'clock. Time for news.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.